I am Andrew Kirk.
Andrew, I understand that you knew Schaefer and knew Schaefer well. So I'm interested in on what occasion, what were the circumstances by which you became acquainted with Schaefer? And at the time, were you a Christian or were you not a Christian?
Well, I think when I tell you the answer, you'll know that I was a Christian. I became a Christian when I was doing my national service. That was about 1956. I was in Berlin at the time. When I came out, I did my 2 years and then came out, went up to university in London to do a first degree, and then went on from there to Cambridge for theological training for the ministry. And I was at an institution called Ridley Hall, which is, belongs to the Church of England. And it was there that I first met Schaefer. I can't remember exactly the circumstances or how it came to be, but I do remember the time, that is to say, and something of what he was speaking about. It was a time of considerable theological flux. A book called Soundings had come out in the early 1960s, which called into question a lot of the Orthodox Christian faith. It was written, I think, by a group of Cambridge dons, or it might have been, might have gone wider than that. And then it was around about that time that John Robinson wrote his Honest to God. And I'd actually done my first degree, which was a London BD at King's College London. And we had a real mixed bag of lecturers, teachers there. Some very radical, and one or two very conservative. So it wasn't totally new to me what was being said at that time. But nevertheless, what impressed me, I think, about Schaefer's approach was the way he put it into a long historical context. And said one shouldn't be surprised by this new, very radical or liberal theology that's coming out, because the culture has shifted or moved in this direction. And these people are simply, in a way, adapting their thoughts to cultural norms. But one has to understand that in the what he would call the flow of history. So that's what impressed me, I think. And that was the year that I then, later in the year, I got ordained. Incidentally, that summer, 1963, a group of us went overland to, I say this because it's connected to Schaefer in a sort of roundabout way, a group of us went overland to Palestine, Israel. And one of them was Os Guinness in that party, who of course, became very much part of Le Brie for a time in the 1970s, I guess. So yes, that was the time, really. That was before Schaefer had written anything.
Right, he doesn't, his book, The God Who Was There, comes out, what, 1968,
right.
I think, and that was fell out of the lectures that he had done at Wheaton, but he also did them at Westmont as
right.
well, and that, as I think, more or less put Schaefer in a way on the map.
Yeah.
Within
I
the
can tell you a bit
world.
About that.
Well, good.
Because I was partly instrumental in its publication.
Why don't you? We have
or
the manuscript.
Or is that going on too far?
We have the manuscript of the lectures themselves.
Right.
But then you went ahead and worked with Schaefer.
That's right.
And so tell me that process.
Well, I got to know Ranald McCauley, and still know him. Well, in fact, he preached at our wedding. We asked Schaefer to do it, but he was in Switzerland and so on, so we got the next best thing, one of his son-in-laws. And he was living in Ealing at the time, West London. And I can't remember, he probably showed me the sort of typed, you know, it had been typed out, hadn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
Somebody had taken the lectures and actually typed them.
Yes.
And asked me what I thought about them. And I said, well, it's extremely interesting stuff, but the English is hopeless. Well, you know Schaefer's style, you know, of speaking. It's well, it's very powerful and very penetrating, but it doesn't easily convert into a book, you know, into a written record. So I, being young and brash at the time, said that I would have a go at trying to, you know, without losing its sense,
yes,
try and put it into what I consider was very, very arrogant, perhaps, a better English. And so I did that, and it was typed up. I probably went out to Le Brie, and it was typed up there, you know, with the changes and so on. Mm-hmm. And then Schaefer invited me out. I think we worked for about 3 weeks together, almost entirely. He was not doing anything else. I mean, it was very concentrated stuff. You know, he wanted to be absolutely sure that what had been said or what had been the changes that had happened was exactly what he wanted to say. And then I think David Winter then went over it again. So that's the story of the God who is there.
Did you only use those lecture, the typed up lecture, the transcript of the lectures, or did you merge any other documents with that?
No, just that.
Just that.
Mm. Yeah, so I would imagine that the finished book would have been reasonably close to the, you know, to the original lectures.
They are. The first part of the lectures, that's not explicit. It's woven in, but it's not explicit in the book. But those lectures, I think, were, in a sense, if we could say it, sort of puts Schaefer on the evangelical map.
That's right.
They were, here we are in a small, well, it was a Christian college, wasn't huge. And at that time, after those lectures, of course, that's why we get it typed up, because everybody said, this is so wonderful. Can we have it? And of course, then they had to work through with the college in Westmont to say how they would be typed up, because he had in mind that would become a book, so we want to be very careful about what was shared. There are probably some copies of that. We have one copy of it, but there are probably other people that have kept copies around or something. I don't know. But that was, so you're very early on with Schaefer in that sense.
Yeah, well, I think, I presume that it was his first sort of putting together his systematic thoughts. You know, I mean, taking a lot of his lectures and so on, and actually putting it together in a coherent way, mm-hmm. And producing a, you know, his basic philosophy, his basic groundwork, as it were, how he wanted to approach the whole question of presenting the Christian faith in the contemporary world. And that's why I think probably, you know, it proved so so powerful, so invigorating. And obviously began to attract more and more people to Le Brie. Well, that's another story.
What amazes me is that the book, The God Who Was There, coming out of the lectures at Wheaton, but the lectures were delivered for Spiritual Emphasis Week at Wheaton.
Right.
And I think today if we would have said, oh, that's the lecture that came out of Spiritual Emphasis Week, we'd scratch our heads and say, so how does that fit? But Schaefer knew precisely what he was doing, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, and he wrote the book True Spirituality, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
So you worked with the man. So what do you have to say about the man?
Well, as a human being, we worked together very well, I think. He obviously trusted me, and I was quite young at the time. This would have been, it was the beginning of 1967 that we worked together, I think January. So I would have been 30 then. I think there was a good rapport. I think he very much considered the person as a person. I remember him saying more than once on a number of occasions, you know, it's not worth winning the argument and losing the person. In other words, you are dealing with, you're not just dealing with ideas, you're not just dealing with philosophies, and culture and so on, you are actually dealing with people who are immersed in this and, you know, who may be hurting as a result of this because they've taken on board, you know, strange ideas or, So, I think that impressed. He was willing to give time to people. He was a disciplined person, I would say, meticulous in preparing for his lectures. Would spend you know a long time on that. He was also, of course, quite an athletic man. He used to ski a lot, didn't he? Used to walk a lot. A very much an all-round person, I would say, particularly in his, in his approach to life, the way that Le Brie was set up. And of course, Edith was also very key in that.
Yes.
You know, almost handing over his family and his home and so on to his children's friends from university and then allowing it to expand. Not a lot of people would do that, I think. So in a way, how much private life he would have had, you know, is difficult to gauge. Because in a way he was always available. Not just at mealtimes. I mean, mealtimes obviously was particularly, you know, who's available. But at other times as well, I felt. I don't know if that answers the question.
Yes. Because we're looking at, people know ideas of Schaefer. He's written.
Yeah.
But we simply, part of our aim here is to put those ideas in the context of the man.
Yes.
Of one who had to live in this world and live quite publicly because of the way Le Brie was structured. So it does answer the question. I heard or read that where Schaefer made the statement, something to this effect, I believe, that when you are speaking to a person, that person in front of you, you see them, him or her, first as a human being and not as a sinner. Would you say that is how he engaged people, unbelievers who would be there at Le Bris?
Well, I think he was always conscious, very much conscious of, you know, of the importance of being human, created in the image of God, as he frequently said, and the fact that that gave you automatically an insight into whoever it was that you met or you were talking to, however distinct their characters may have been or their background, their experiences and so on. Nevertheless, there was something that bound us all together. And I think he was very, very conscious of that. That's why the phrase, you know, you can win the argument and lose the person, and that's, you know, that's tragic. Because they are somebody who is, you know, infinitely loved by God as a human being, whoever they are and whatever they've done. I would say, you know, that came across. We all fail. So there would be, I mean, I don't record particular failures. I can think of one thing in which I quite strongly disagreed with him. Mm-hmm. But that was almost a bit later on. I think that the human very much came through in his case. And he did things like, you know, if you live in Switzerland, you ski. I mean, you know, it's, he did ordinary things, you know. I mean, he wasn't, he looked a bit like a professor, of course, with his goatee beard. And he adapted to the culture, the context. You know, he wore Swiss kind of clothes. He wouldn't have been out of place in that sense. Learned the French language, I guess. To what extent, I don't know, because I never heard him speaking French. And he went originally as a missionary, didn't he?
Yes, and that's, Schaefer would think of himself as that. Mm. You probably know that 63, early... later, a little bit later than that, but in 1960, as you know, the Time magazine article that came out on Schaefer. It was not a large article, but it was in Time magazine, and in that they referred to Schaefer as the missionary to the European intellectual.
Right.
And that's pretty early on when you consider that Le Bris starts in 55.
Yes.
In 5 years.
Well, I think he went originally, did he not go originally, something to do with being a children's, an emphasis on children's mission? Or...
Yes, that was their initial reason for going. In 1948, he had been, traveled through Europe, I think in 47, for maybe 3 months. And because here we are, you know, 2-3 years after World War Two.
Yes.
And Europe had been devastated.
Yes.
And so, but he'd had that ministry with children when he was in the States.
Right.
But you're right, that's what he goes for. So this was not the real intention.
No.
Initially, but it just grew into that. I think it was when Priscilla started going to the university. Yes. And then students would come and, somebody up in the chalet there who can answer questions.
Yes.
Who will... In those days, people were really asking some very serious and good questions. You say that this idea about you wouldn't want to win the argument and lose the person. Do you think that was evident in his dialogue with Bishop Pike?
Oh, I don't think I know enough about it.
Okay.
It's a question of how you conduct the argument, the discussion. I guess. I imagine he could be quite angry because he saw how these views destroyed people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people, particularly people who came to him early on in Le Brie, you know, were people not just intellectually looking for answers to intellectual questions, but people who were looking for answers to the whole of life.
Yeah.
And who were already, you know, maybe sort of in a fairly nihilistic situation. So it was very, in that sense, yeah. existential, it, you know. It was the yeah. existential questions about how do they make sense of their life in the midst of the intellectual traditions of particularly the continent, I would say. And this was a time, you know, the time of existentialism, which he majored on in his in many of his lectures.
Yes, this whole idea of true truth, which would have just flown straight to the face of existentialism. And of course, Camus and Sartre and these people, the students were reading them in the university.
Exactly.
And as you say, it rips away any real sense of purpose, a meaning in life. And as he would say, something to the effect, well, you can try to live that way for a time, but reality will push back at you.
Yes.
You know. Yeah. And maybe they early on, these students, because they were thinking, they could see that it would be starting to push back on them.
So he used to talk about the mannishness of man.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he has some delightful phrases, you know.
Yes.
And by the mannishness of man, he simply meant who you are.
Yes.
You know, created in the image of God.
Yes.
In God's world. And however much you may rebel against it or not understand it, you're still in the image of God.
Yes.
That is very, very powerful.
And it did explain life because of the fall and the mannishness of man.
Yeah.
You could see both of those things side by side. Why is man so cruel? And surely, here we are early on. I mean, you're not that far from World War II and some of the great atrocities of that time. But on the other hand, you could see people doing beautiful works of art and works of compassion. Who could explain that?
I agree, yeah.
But Schaefer did have the way of explaining it, didn't he?
Yes.
That we are, what does he say? I think in one place he says we're noble. In another place, I think he refers to the glorious ruins.
Yes.
That.
Yeah.
Did you went to Le Brie for a while? I mean, when you were working on.
Well, I went to Le Brie before 67.
All right.
I think it must have been, it's probably in the summer of 66.
Mm-hmm.
And I went with a very good friend of mine from Ridley Hall called Colin Chapman, mm-hmm. who's written quite a lot on the Middle East.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the girl I was courting at the time, who's now my wife, the three of us went together and stayed for 2 or 3 weeks there. Oh, and I think I took my sister and nephew as well along at that time. We all went together. We had one of these big sort of camper vans,
mm-hmm.
and we went across Europe. So 67 wasn't the first time I'd been in Le Brie, nor was it the last time.
Because
mm-hmm. then in 68 we went out to Argentina. 67 I went, and then I came back in 68, married my wife, and then we went together out to Argentina. And then we came back on our first leave in 71. And then we spent 3 months at Le Brie. So, you know, I got to know the whole, I mean, I did a lot of, obviously, you know, listening to tapes and so on at that time. And Latin America was a very, very interesting context at that time, because it was the beginning of very radical thinking in the Catholic Church, beginning of liberation theology.
Yes.
The whole oppressive regimes of the military, and a lot of the young people. Oh, it was also 1968 was the year of what they call it. Was the year of the revolutions on campuses all across the world. And what did they had the year of something.
Well, they call, the title that has been given is the knife year, 1968.
Yes.
Martin Luther King is assassinated. Bobby Kennedy is assassinated. You have the riots.
Oh, you've got that, yes.
And you have the riots on the campuses.
That's right, yes.
And I think, maybe it's an overstatement, I think certainly the West was never the same after that.
No. It was the year after Che Guevara was captured and killed in Bolivia. And going back to South America.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the student revolts started in Argentina, in the University of Cordoba, I gather. And, but it was fairly simultaneous, in right across. Argentina is intellectually very much influenced by the French, France, and it was certainly very manifest in France at that time. But what it did was to radicalize some of the theological students as well. And they became very, very socialist in their attitudes. You had the sort of background of Cuba. Cuba was, by some of these people, the younger generation, idealized, as Che Guevara was idealized. And that sort of played itself out. So, that was all very new to me. And I was, still trying to grapple with the world views that were going on. And these were new elements, the more political involvement, the more political side of things. Schaefer did a huge amount on culture and history and philosophy and the arts and so on. He did from time to time delve into political matters. But not so much, I would say. So one had to find one's way through this, still using the framework, as it were, to try and make sense of this.
So did you find...
That's all background to my 71 3 months in Le Brie.
Yes. So this idea of flow of history, I think Schaefer, as an evangelical, may be one of the first to, at least in the 20th century, to do that sort of a thing. That is to map out the big picture, to connect the dots. So if this idea takes hold, then it's not surprising that this is what happens after that.
Mm.
So did you find that sort of a framework to be helpful as you were laboring in?
Yes, I think it was distinguishing in the thinking that was going on in some theological circles, including liberation theology, which I did a major study of in the 1970s, distinguishing between what is good in it, what is biblical in it, and, basically what it's left out, because it tended to become, again, rather idealistic, rather utopian in terms of, a socialism of the future. Not the Soviet kind of socialism, but a socialism that would be autochthonous to Latin America. It was quite a struggle to work through that, because I think some of the issues around justice, for example, were very pertinent around the prophetic calling, as one understands it, particularly from the Old Testament biblical prophets. But they, you know, in my opinion, they left out things. They overstepped the mark, and they began to interpret scripture in a way which was very much from a particular perspective, without having the counterbalance to that. But that's, you know, I read a book on the subject at the end of the, you know, the beginning of the, well, no, the end of the 1970s, yes. So that was, yeah, I mean, undoubtedly Schaefer was a big influence in the way I approached it.
Did you ever, was the God Who's There ever translated into any South American language?
I didn't know, but I imagine it must have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you wouldn't have done something.
No, I wouldn't have trusted my Spanish.
Okay. All right. Yeah. You worked with Schaefer. You've been at LaBrie. We talked about something about the man. You actually had to work with him in terms of coming to an agreement on this book. But you felt that you and Schaefer were pretty much on the same page when you were doing that?
Yes, I think so. I mean, obviously, I got to know his thought pretty closely by, you know, I mean, when you're actually working on a manuscript, mm-hmm. and you're saying, you know, is there a better way, or is there a, you know, a way that communicates better in the language of what he's trying to say? You had to work out exactly, you know, because some of his language is very idiosyncratic. not just because he was an American, you know, he had a way of putting things. Sometimes the illustrations and the way he put it was very arresting, you know. And very memorable, some of the language, and it, you know, when you're listening to it, it hits you in a particular way. When you're reading on a page, you're looking at it in a different kind of a way. You're analysing it more because it's all there, it's still there, and it's there tomorrow, and it's there the next day. When you're listening to it, you hear it once, you know, and it makes an impact or it doesn't, and. The tapes, of course, were recorded, so you could go back to them. But and part of Schaefer is his voice, after all. It's part of all of us, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
So I don't think it put people off. I think it was, you know, it was part of his personality, part of who he was.
I think with Lewis, C.S. Lewis, who... I think it was Mere Christianity, which were a series of lectures, right? And he thought that they should be done just as they were spoken.
Oh, they were a broadcast, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
Broadcast That's you right. did in the war?
Yes. Mm. And so when he tried to put it in the book, he just tried to keep that and realized that's not, as you're saying, that doesn't work well. It works well for speaking, but it doesn't... that. How you put things together doesn't necessarily work that good for the written word.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I remember Schaefer saying something along these lines. I think this is pretty close to it. That if you want perfection or nothing, you'll get nothing every time.
Yes, yes, yes. Very true.
And so... He would not have been a perfectionist, but even though he did study hard, did preparation, do you think he was a man who was willing to amend his thoughts if later down the way he had seen that it could be said better, or something should be left out, or something should be added to?
Oh, I think so, very much. I mean, I think in the conversations around meal tables, for example, he would. You know, he would use an illustration where somebody challenged him and he had to rethink. And maybe say it in a different way, maybe say something different from the way he put it the first time. He would be willing to be corrected, I think. Some people felt that Schaefer generalized too much. If you were an expert on, I don't know, Sartre or somebody like this, you know, you really had delved into his writings and so on, they might have felt that Schaefer had taken out what was convenient for his, you know, for his whole approach to Sartre, but left other parts of Sartre unsaid. And they would say this. I mean, you know, it was a very honest kind of conversation. Were you ever involved in one of his round table conversations?
No. I'd become a Christian in 65. My first encounter with Schaefer writings was secondhand in the late 60s by people who read Schaefer, or at least some of what Schaefer said, and become very antinomian. And that would not have been where Schaefer would have landed. But that just, I put Schaefer off and said no. Then in the late 70s, I was reintroduced to Schaefer, this time to read it for myself, and realized somebody got it terribly wrong early on. And so I was greatly, greatly helped. Things like honest questions deserve honest answers. You don't have to commit something like, you don't have to commit intellectual suicide to become a Christian. So Schaefer was, and it was that just really just turned my world around. I had studied philosophy as a high school student and had questions and realized the philosophers couldn't answer it. So then I became a Christian 2 years after my high school graduation. But I'd never really thought hard about it because the community that into which I was ushered, and they were wonderful people, but there it was, you don't ask questions, you just believe. But then all of a sudden, those old questions that I had back in high school began to bubble up. And to say I was frustrated, well, we do what most people do, I guess. I say, and like I try to swallow, and go back down, you know, we can't ask this question. But when I heard and read Schaefer say that, so that was just very powerful to me, liberating, I think. I never met Schaefer personally. I heard him speak maybe 3 weeks before he died at one of his, when he was traveling to different university campuses, sort of doing the promotional for the Great Evangelical Disaster. So I'm a Johnny come lately. So this is why I enjoy being able to sit down and talk with people who knew Schaefer. And I have to say, I've never heard anything that astounded me and said, no, that can't be right.
And what they said.
Yes. Because what they said was consistent with what I read and the tone with which it was written.
Yes. No, I think that's right. I mean, the last time, because we were overseas in the 1970s, and he died, what, early 1980s?
84.
Yes. So rather, after being there for 71, the last time I think that I saw him or met him or talked to him was at Lausanne 74. I was at Lausanne 74.
You were there?
Yes.
Wow. If you
which
said
was a
that.
Very, very remarkable experience.
Absolutely. So can you tell me about the speech? What is it? Two realities, two contents.
Yeah.
What was it like?
Well, I would have to go back and read it, you know.
Oh, I don't care about the content.
No.
But what was the atmosphere like when Schaefer spoke?
I can tell you one thing.
Yes.
There were three people, three speakers, main speakers,
yes.
Mainline speakers, who got a standing ovation. One was Malcolm Muggeridge.
Mm-hmm.
Another was a colleague of mine from Latin America, René Padilla. And the third was Schaefer. I mean, not in that order.
No.
No. So he got a standing ovation. And I think probably as much for what he represented as for that particular, you know, that particular speech. So he was, I would say he was highly, highly respected by the evangelical world. A lot of whom probably hadn't read anything of his, but you know, that's that's the way it often is.
Yes.
But, you know, the image of Schaeffer and what he'd done for the evangelical cause, or the, you know, for biblical Christianity. For his uniqueness in a way, you know, that nobody else had, you know, if I go back to 1963 when I first met him, there were people like, his name's gone, Fundamentalism and the Word of God, author.
Packer,
yes, Jim Packer. Jim Packer, who was also, you know, entering the fray. But he did it on a different sort of plane, much more theological, a theological engagement with these radical theologians, whereas Schaeffer was much broader, I would say, in his approach. I mean, the theology was there, but it was much more a cultural engagement, I think. And that, you know, that, and I think that people, you know, had taken that on board, that somehow Schaeffer had opened our eyes to what was going on in the Western world.
Yes.
In a way that, I mean, people like Jim Packer had a terrific mind,
mm-hmm.
But hadn't quite grasped the wholeness of the situation. But if you go back to the 19th century, the early 19th century, you know, and the beginnings of Schleiermacher and onwards, yes. You know, all heavily influenced by the culture around them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all there, but it never been sort of brought out. And I think you know, people appreciated that at Lausanne. Bearing in mind that it was an international congress, so there were people from all over the world, but mm-hmm. then people from all over the world had studied at Le Brie. And it wasn't just Westerners.
Yes.
Quite a number of people from Asia in particular had been there.
Of course, Schleiermacher would have done some sort of a retreat from the idea of reason, whereas that was his way of saving things, whereas Schaeffer was willing to step forward and say, no, we can speak to this issue because Christianity speaks to all of life.
Yeah.
And
because God has given us a reason.
Yes, that's right.
You know, I mean he would say, I mean, it's interesting how it comes back, you know. Rationality is part of God's gift to human yes. beings. And it can be distorted, it can be yes. used in all sorts of ways, but it's not wrong in itself.
And he would make those kind of distinctions, again, between being something being rational and rationalism.
Yes.
And he would make those kind of distinctions that people just kind of floated over. And, of course, it confused conversations because people were not saying the same thing. And so I always found that, I very appreciated that in Schaeffer when you talk about humanism. And, you know, humanity, and how you had to use those words carefully to say what you wanted to say. So,
yeah, and the whole question of what is faith, you know, and it's not what Kierkegaard said it was, for example.
Yeah.
Faith is not against reason.
Yes.
It's not against science. Science is another gift of God.
Yes.
I mean, it's simply unfolding God's creation. You know, it's looking at reality and discovering, and God has allowed this to happen because creation is, in the last resort, is contingent. God never had to create. You know, so it's not sacred in that sense.
Yes.
You know, that you can't touch it. All this came through. So if science appears to contradict Christian belief, then, either Christian belief is not understood, as Richard Dawkins, doesn't understand it, or science has got it wrong, and has to come back and rethink it and look at it again. There couldn't be a contradiction.
In the book, The God Who Is There, that you worked on, in there, Schaefer says that Christianity is true because it's true to what is.
Yes, that's right, absolutely.
So, well, I think we as evangelicals, whether we want to admit it or not, have a great debt to Schaefer. I think he awakened the evangelical conscience, not in a big bang, but over time. And I think, and maybe I'm overstating the case, but I think evangelical Christianity would look somewhat different today if there would not have been a Francis Schaefer.
Yeah.
I
think he influenced everybody. I mean, some of the great evangelical leaders like John Stott, mm-hmm. Who I also knew very well mm-hmm. and worked with for a time. He began to understand evangelical faith in a broader, in a broader context, in broader categories, partly as a result of Schaefer.
I have read a considerable amount of correspondence between Schaefer and other evangelicals. And one of the things that amazes me is the number of evangelical luminaries that wrote to Schaefer mm-hmm. and respected what Schaefer had to say.
Yeah.
Maybe not always agreeing with him, but would write to him. And that goes to the point, that you made about even Lausanne in 74, that people by that time had come to respect Schaefer.
Well, he was always thoughtful. I mean, he would yes. always have responded very thoughtfully.
Mm-hmm.
And he would not have responded in cliches, mm. I guess, or evangelical rhetoric yes. or something like this. A lot of it would have seemed quite original because he'd thought it through.
Yes.
I was talking to somebody yesterday, actually, and we got into a conversation about, not a Christian at all, the existence of God and so on and so forth. And at the end of the conversation, he paid me the compliment mm-hmm. of saying I was one of the first, if not the only, clergyman he'd met who didn't speak in cliches.
And there was a freshness too of Schaefer, wasn't it?
Yes.
He wasn't saying new theology. He was saying it in a way that somehow stuck with people. It fit. It made sense of what they were seeing in their world. So it's a great compliment that somebody should pay that.
And I think, obviously he was, as a good evangelical ought to do, but we don't always do, and that is submit ourselves, our minds, everything to Scripture.
Yes.
And to the center of Scripture, Jesus Christ, so that, he would allow Scripture to judge him
yes.
and correct him if necessary. And I'm sure that, he would never, ever have said that what he said about Scripture was the last word.
Mm-hmm.
Always be open-ended,
yes.
Always under the word to be corrected. And that, I think, is, that shows a certain humility as well. So he never came across as arrogant, in my experience. He came across, because he believed in truth, as reasonably certain that his approach was the right approach, but never in an arrogant way, never in a dismissive way, never saying, you know, well, you've got it all wrong. You're a hopeless case. You know, there's not much can be done. You won't listen. That's what I mean by treating the other as a human being. You know, and it's very easy when you're discussing something at a deep level, a deep rational level, to say, but why can't you see this? You know, you just won't see it. You know. So that was, honest answers for honest questions.
Yeah, I think that is what you've just said is so spot on and important to be said by those of you who knew Schaefer and watched him engage, because that's why he could be so effective with the unbeliever. If I think that it's not that we don't think we have the truth. Obviously we do. But if that is how we begin it, and the only choice for the person over on the other side is to cross the line before we can talk, then...
Yeah,
not much could be said, could it?
No, I think it's also because he didn't feel under threat.
Yes.
You know, I mean, so many, particularly leaders of churches often feel under threat, and they dismiss threat by just being dogmatic. but if you don't feel under threat, if you feel that there are genuine, real answers, and those answers are answers not just to your mind, but to your whole life, to your moral life and everything else, then you can approach it in a different way.
Well, Andrew, those are great words to...
Sorry, I'm preaching.
those are great words, Andrew, to bring our conversation to a close today. I truly appreciate and have enjoyed our conversation. It's been delightful. And as one who did not know Schaefer, as you and others have, it's a great privilege of mine to be able to sit and to listen to you confirm what I thought to be the case. So thank you very much and for doing this for us.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for your questions and